Shrink Wrap Radio number 386, an update on mind expanding substances with Dr. Ralph Metzger.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Ralph Metzner about all things consciousness and psychedelic, though, as we will learn, he's not fond of that term. Ralph Metzner, Ph.D., a graduate of Oxford and Harvard, is a recognized pioneer in psychological, philosophical, and cross-cultural studies of consciousness and its transformations. He collaborated with Leary and Alpert in classic studies of psychedelics at Harvard University in the 1960s, co-authored The Psychedelic Experience, and was editor of The Psychedelic Review. He is a psychotherapist and professor emeritus at the California Institute of Integral Studies, where he was also the academic dean for 10 years in the 1980s. His books include The Unfolding Self, The Well of Remembrance, Green Psychology, The Expansion of Consciousness, Alchemical Divination, and Mind, Space, and Time Stream. He's the editor of two collections of essays on the pharmacology, anthropology, and phenomenology of ayahuasca and of psilocybin mushrooms. He's also the president and co-founder of the Green Earth Foundation, dedicated to healing and harmonizing the relations between humanity and the earth. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ralph Metzner, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to have you on the show. I think we've met a couple of times over the years. We certainly have lots of mutual friends, and I've been hearing about your work for years. You're a widely recognized authority on consciousness and altered states of consciousness and psychedelics. Uh-huh. And so I've wanted to talk to you. So let's start by reaching back into your history. I believe you knew both Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass at Harvard, but I don't know in what capacity you were at Harvard or how you came to be in their circle. Maybe we can start there.
Sure. I was a graduate student, and they were two professors.
Okay.
At Harvard in the late 50s, early 60s. I was there from 1958 to I had come over from England and did my undergraduate degree in psychology at Oxford University. And I joined the Harvard, what they called the Center for Research and Personality, which was, and did a PhD there that covered also social psychology, clinical psychology, social anthropology, and sociology. So it was kind of an interdisciplinary program. And they were two of the professors, and then I took courses from them. And then after I had been there about 2 years, actually, Leary did this thing where he went during his vacation, he discovered accidentally, unknowingly, or stumbled across the ancient Mexican magic mushroom, so-called magic mushrooms. And then his life was changed by that. He had a life-changing experience, and he kept talking about it, and then we initiated a series of research projects on psilocybin, the synthetic equivalent of the magic mushroom, which had only recently been identified and which nobody knew anything about. And so Harvard initiated Leary and Alpert and a group of other graduate students, about a dozen or more graduate students, initiated a series of projects on psilocybin.
And so were you involved in any of that research?
Yeah, I was. I was one of about half a dozen or so graduate students. And the two main projects that the basic thing was, we called a naturalistic study, where we were giving questionnaires to relatively sophisticated people, not undergraduates. We weren't allowed to use undergraduates, and we didn't, but graduate students and ordinary people, artists and writers and people that had some history of exploring their consciousness, and designed questionnaires and gave it to them. And then we did the study on the prison rehabilitation, working with convicted prisoners. And that was part of the study that I worked on with several other students, where we were giving the idea of giving convicted criminals an eye-opening insight kind of experience, insight into themselves, and then seeing, because there was a behavioral index, Harvard was very big on behaviorism in those days, and Skinner was, you know, one of the main people, and so there were behavioral index would be recidivism rate. Could we reduce the recidivism rate, the rate of which people, prisoners return for new prisons, for new crimes after they've been released from prison? And so that was a project that involved then, and Leary's insight, I think, and really genius in that was to recognize that you couldn't just do this. This was not a drug that automatically changed people's behavior. It wasn't like that. It was a drug that provided an experience from which insights could and behavior changes could result if the set in the setting was correct, was right in that direction. Set and setting, that was his formula that he found, and that's been accepted in the field, the intention that you bring to it and the setting or the context. And so that's and so then what we also did was and what he also insisted on, I think correctly, was that you couldn't just give the person a drug and observe their behavior. That was not the right model, because there's no behavior to observe. The drug produces an experience, and the only way to get that experience is to ask the person what they're experiencing. So and Leary insisted right away that you can't, like he used to joke, you know, you give a person a psychedelic drug and there's no behavior to observe. They might just sit there or lie there and every now and again explain, oh, that's amazing, or that's incredible.
Yeah, right. And oh, wow.
There's no behavior, you see, because everything is happening inside. Sure. So the only way you get what's going on is to ask the person, and I'll tell them, and then of course the experimenter, the so-called person giving the drug, has to have had the experience himself. Doesn't have to take it at the same time. He has to have had the experience. Otherwise, he has no clue, absolutely zero idea of what might be going on with the person. Unless you've experienced it yourself, you won't do it. And that's a fact, and that's a fact that's widely accepted in the field to this day. I mean, there are research projects now going on with the psilocybin and LSD and all these other drugs. But to a person, all the researchers who are doing it have themselves experienced the drug.
Yeah.
Although they're not allowed to say that in their scientific publications, and they're supposed to pretend they're behaviorists and that they're not involved in the da-da-da-da. But it's a known fact that they all, to a person, have, and they don't write about that experience in their write-ups of the experiments. So it was a kind of an interesting situation. See, they're not like any other drug.
Well, two questions that come up for me. One is I want to, you know, find out what your experience was with psilocybin, since you know, you've just pointed out that was an important qualification, but also how those studies turned out in terms of what you learned. So you can start with whichever one you want.
I don't actually talk about my experience in public anymore.
Okay.
I feel that as a researcher, that's not necessary. I've had enough experiences to know to know what the general space is like, and I've done in the past studies with people where we ask people and collect data from experiences, comparing experiences under different conditions. It's a naturalistic study, but involves, of course, introspection and questionnaire studies and stuff like that, and systematizing. And we conducted several studies and published papers in the literature. The two main projects at Harvard that I concentrated on was this study with convicted criminals, giving them psilocybin and in the prison. And there was a group of us graduate students and also the prisoners. And because of Leary's commitment to having this be a collaborative research project, not experimenter and subject, which is a hierarchical relationship. You know, the experimenter and the subject.
Yeah.
Even says subject. You know, the experimenter is doing something to the subject.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Leary said he had this belief in existential transactional kind of thing. This is a collaborative research project. We gave the substance to the prisoners. We took it with them. We took it with them, and this is where everybody said, "Oh, you're completely mad. These are dangerous criminals. They're in, you know, all this kind of violence will come out." Well, this was complete nonsense. No, there was not a single moment of violence in those studies, and we, you know, I had half a dozen or more and so did other graduate, fellow graduate students and friends of mine in a prison, in a maximum security prison.
Yeah.
With these prisoners, because we would take, we would have a group of prisoners, a group of graduate students, half the students, half the total group would take psilocybin in the morning, and the other half would be assisting, observing, helping, being there, talking, and then in the afternoon we'd switch around. So everybody had both the experience of sitting with or experiencing subjectively. And we collected data and interviews and questionnaires and so forth. And we looked at the recidivism rate. Now, the recidivism rate data were not convincing because there's so many factors enter into, you know, whether how and whether a convicted criminal will return to prison after he's been released. And like, he has to have some kind of follow-up, halfway house, da-da-da, job, search, all those kind of things. We couldn't prove that just having one or more, three or four experiences with psilocybin would change a convict into a Buddha, which is kind of Leary's simplistic formula at the time. But he was an Irish jokester, you know. But
yeah.
He did show profound changes on personality tests. We gave them personality tests like the California CPI and before and after and interviews and Rorschachs and all those kinds of things. And follow-up after 6 months and 5 years and 20 years later there were follow-up. The people generally said that this was the most profound life-changing experience. We just weren't able to demonstrate it by behavioral indices.
Okay.
But that's true of this kind of research in general. It's not a drug therapy where you have a placebo control. That's the other thing. You don't have a placebo-controlled thing. This is not the appropriate model for that kind of research. So that was one of the studies that we did at Harvard. And the other study, which actually was a double-blind placebo-controlled study, was Walter Pankey, who was getting his PhD in this religion. He already had a theology degree and an MD. He was an MD. And so he did a study which we participated in and collaborated with as research assistants on it was called the Good Friday study, where maximizing the set and the setting. These were divinity students, and the service was held in a chapel on Good Friday in 1963 or 2 or something like that. And so the set and the setting was all to maximize religious experience, and Walter Pankey gave them interviews and questionnaires on mystical experience before and after. And he did have placebo double-blind control studies. In other words, half the people got a placebo, which was a ridiculous ritual because after, 20 minutes, everybody knew who had had the placebo and psilocybin. The people who had the placebo were kind of pissed off because they missed out on the experience.
That's funny. Yeah, I remember Walter
Pankey's
research.
That's kind of a ritualistic thing that you supposedly have to do.
Now, what was your doctoral dissertation on?
Oh, my doctoral dissertation was on something completely different. Because the chairman of the department, David McClellan, said to those of us who were working with Tim Leary and Alpert that we couldn't do it. Because he was opposed to – see, he was a behaviorist himself. So he didn't think that we should study these experiences by taking the substance ourselves.
Yeah. So did you suffer at all?
He said, no, you can't do your PhD. You got to do your PhD on something else. So I did it on something else. With Walter Michel, who was another professor there, and then continued to work on the project in my spare time, so to speak.
Well, just out of curiosity, what was the something else that you worked on?
It was on this idea of delaying gratification. It was an educational psychology. Walter Michel was a person there who had developed this kind of simple methodology for seeing how the ability to delay gratification, you know, where will a child learn to forego an immediate reward for the sake of a larger reward later on?
Well, it really was what you were doing on the side that seems to have shaped your subsequent career.
You know, that's what we were interested in.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff with the consciousness expanding substances, which is what we call them, and which incidentally is a term that Leary came up with, which I now think want to come back to and prefer that term, consciousness expanding, and to the term psychedelic, because the term psychedelic has accrued all kinds of other sort of cultural association, like paisley colors and swirling blah blah, like that. You know, my daughter, when she was 9 years old, one time said, "Oh, look at that psychedelic blah da da da." You know, and that's not the most significant aspect of a psychedelic experience. You know, the most significant aspect is that it gives you insight into the way your mind works. Given an appropriate set and setting. Of course, if your setting is that you're taking it at a rave dance or at a rock concert, well, then it's not necessarily going to give you any insight into your how your mind works. It might, but it's kind of, it all depends on the set and setting, you see, where the drug is simply a catalyst or an amplifier, some people call it a non-specific amplifier of perception. So it doesn't produce an effect. It's not like, take this drug and have this effect.
Yeah. Now, was there any fallout for you in your academic career by dint of your association with Leary and Alpert, or did you manage to escape that?
Well, academic fallout, I mean...
Yeah, that's what I meant, academic fallout.
Well, no, because, you know, when we did the project at Harvard for, I finished my PhD. I wasn't fired from Harvard. I didn't have a job at Harvard.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, I finished my PhD and then I did a postdoctoral fellowship in psychopharmacology. And we continued to work on the different projects even after Harvard, you know, stopped the projects under Harvard auspices. But Leary and Alpert and about a dozen other colleagues and friends and other graduate students and people not from the university collaborated. You know, Leary started working a lot with artists and writers and poets and people like Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs and musicians of various kinds, artists that would be have expected from their lifestyle and their basic orientation to have an interest in expansions of consciousness. And working with them, collecting data all the time, doing interviews, questionnaires, talking to people, because you've got to recognize that these were completely new experiences. There was nothing, absolutely nothing in our personal background or in our reading or in the study of psychology on anybody's part. Leary's, Alpert's, mine, Frank Behrens, the Harvard professors, nobody had any clue that such a thing could exist as a mushroom or a substance of some kind. You know, LSD had been discovered in the mid-40s, and so there were some adventurous psychiatrists who had started using it, and of course the CIA and the military were using it for brainwashing, blah, 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 but it was not in any sense of term in the mainstream. It's often very hard to get that. You know, nowadays you say LSD and it has all kinds of associations in people's mind. In those days, early 60s, you could have said LSD or XYZ or IBM, meant nothing.
Right.
No association whatsoever, good or bad, legal or illegal. It was totally legal. Everything was completely legal. We weren't breaking any laws. The laws were made afterwards, you see.
Yeah.
So I've had the experience twice now in my life because that I was doing some research, getting really good results. Nobody was harmed. Nobody was complaining. None of the people who had the experience were complaining. On the contrary, they wanted to have more of them. And then all of a sudden, by some other political means way beyond my control, it was said, this is now a criminal. You're now a criminal. And if you continue doing what you're doing, you'll go to jail.
Yeah.
And then the same thing happened again later on in the 80s, 20 years later, with ecstasy or MDMA.
Right.
Which is a fantastically valuable, interesting, constructive therapy substance. Actually better for therapy in many ways than LSD or psilocybin. And the same thing happened. You know, after using it, I myself was one of a couple of hundred therapists in the United States and Europe who were using it with really good results, fantastic results for things like trauma and depression and like that. And then through some various political processes, because the drug experience kind of escaped from the academic framework. And lots of people wanted to take the drug.
Yes.
And they didn't want to go and be somebody's research subject. And they didn't want to be somebody's research patient or psychiatric patient, you know, where they maybe from the adventurous psychiatrist they would get it, because they just wanted to get it because they thought it was valuable. They'd heard it was valuable. It was valuable.
And there was a big spread, I recall, in those years, I think in Life magazine or Look magazine, something like that. I think that's one of the first places that I heard about it. And, of course, it ignited a fire and interest. And, whoa, this sounds very fascinating. Right. As a psychologist, I need to know about this.
Exactly. So psychologist, and, you know, Leary is often blamed for popularizing the drug. This is absurd. He would not have, he was like a Harvard professor. Who would pay any attention to what he's saying? And then we were accused of giving the drug to undergraduates. That's ridiculous. Undergraduates were giving us drugs. They had more access to drugs than we did. Now, I remember an undergraduate, Harvard undergraduate, turned me on to marijuana. I had no idea, you know, what it was. And they were able to get mescaline and all kinds of drugs. And they were often much more sophisticated. And and anyway, that's what's not what we were doing. We were not trying to sell. We weren't selling anything. We were not selling anything. We were reporting. These are findings that we were like explorers. We were like people who had gone to South America and, you know, found the Amazon jungle and all these tribes and their culture and their art and all these various things, and came back and said, wow, you know, there's this whole other continent. And there's this whole other, like Marco Polo, you know, when he first came back from China into 13th century Italy, and people said, oh, you're making it up. You know, there's no such thing as these Chinese. You're fantasizing. They didn't believe him.
Yeah,
said, right. Well, go for yourself. You see for yourself. I'm not making it up.
Yeah. Well, of course, later, Leary did turn into more of a salesman. While I was at the University of Michigan, he came and really, really preached the turn on, tune in, and drop out message.
Well, he advocated. You could say he advocated. I mean, he was not a salesman. He never sold any drugs. He never sold any drugs. He never profited from any drugs. In fact, as a result of being associated with the drugs, he spent, you know, 3.5 years in jail, in different jails. So he paid a heavy price for his advocacy.
Yeah.
He was a spokesperson, and his idea was to turn on, tune in, drop out. Was meant metaphorically. It didn't necessarily mean turn on by taking a drug. It meant turn on to the potentials of your mind. Tune in. Tune in meant to tune in to what's going in your mind. You don't just get that automatically by taking the drug. And dropping out didn't necessarily mean, you know, quit your job and live on the streets. It meant, well, drop out of your sort of psychological commitment to the ideology of the culture and question. Mm-hmm. No, I actually like his later slogan better. You learn to use your mind. Use your head, you know. Drop out of your mind and learn to use your head. Because he was an Irishman. He was a satirist. He was in the tradition of people like Jonathan Swift and George Bernard Shaw and James Joyce, and he liked to provoke people into thinking differently. Or in the Native American tradition, there's the concept of a trickster. See, a trickster figure is somebody who teaches you by tricking you out of your ego trips.
Yes.
He doesn't say, this is the way it is, and this is what you should do, and this is what you shouldn't do, because then, you know, he knows how we do all our ego trips and blah, blah, blah. So he doesn't want you to follow him. That's the thing. Leary used to get really pissed off and say all kinds of bad words if people treated him like a guru. He'd say, like, don't give me any of that guru shit. I'm not a guru. I'm just another. Yeah. I'm a fellow explorer, and explore your mind and use it. And, of course, he made mistakes, and, of course, he said stupid things. Who doesn't? You know, I have never made my mistakes and said things I regretted later. And but to say that he caused a lot of people to drop out is ridiculous. People dropped out because they wanted to. And lots of people dropped in. You look at this book that Ramdas and I recently published about 4 years ago called Birth of a Psychedelic Culture. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at that.
We
have a conversations about the Harvard years and Leary. And then we have reports from about ten or a dozen other people, and these are like who were in one way or another marginally or centrally involved with our project at Harvard. And these are all like these are family people. They have family. They didn't drop out. They have PhDs. They're teaching at universities. They work in business. They work in all kinds of fields and arts. And you know, they're the opposite of dropouts. They were not hippies. They might have put on some hippie clothes in the 60s, but that's not the point. You know, they profound changes occurred in their lives. And the fact is that the psychedelic subculture exists. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of people taking these substances on their own, whether the government considers them illegal or not. And they take a risk in doing that. And the risk is that they'll be found out, you know, in some context of selling drugs, or they have to be underground, and they have to be underground. Not that's why I don't like the counterculture, because then it's an underground culture, and it's underground, but that means it's hidden. And but it's not a counterculture; it's not opposed to the mainstream culture. It just you know, people for some have this strange thing that they don't actually like to go to jail. They'd rather not. They'd rather be free. Right. You know, and they have certain interests. Interests that are not approved by the mainstream culture, and so they keep quiet about those interests.
Yeah, that can really complicate the experience. I mean, you know, if you're on LSD or some other mind-expanding substance, and realize that you are now an enemy of the state with all of its resources, and they could come.
You have to recognize that that's
breaking down your door.
Yes, that's right, and it gets even more interesting. You're not actually I wouldn't say an enemy of the state. The people who want to drop out, the hippies, they weren't opposed to the state. See, that's why I said that. Well, the counterculture isn't the right word. I mean, except as a kind of a counterpoint, maybe like a musical counterpoint. You know, questioning the assumptions of the mainstream culture, not wanting to over, not revolutionary, not wanting to overthrow the government. See, that's in the 60s there were people, there were groups that resorted to violence. We all don't know that the Minutemen and you know various other groups that resorted to violent means. But as far as I know, in the drug cultures, the counterculture, it tends to be nonviolent. I mean, you think of the typical marijuana, for example, sociologists that study drug use, they compare alcohol subculture and marijuana subculture. And alcohol subculture is much more violent, hands down, no comparison. Sure. Alcohol releases inhibitions to violence. You know, the typical drunk gets around and swears and is indecent and makes a fool of himself and causes accidents while driving drunk. The typical pot user sits back somewhere and wants to get high. They don't want to drive anywhere, listen to music or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, I'm not advocating they should drive. Of course not. Nobody should drive on anything.
Right.
That's their consciousness.
Now, I've heard that the FDA has begun to loosen up a bit and that there's beginning to be legitimate research on psychedelics again.
Yeah.
And you made some reference to that. Can you share with us anything that you're aware of in terms of any researchers that you might be in contact with or whose work you know, that are currently doing that kind of work?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most significant studies that's going on now is with MDMA, which is actually a kind of a different drug. It's also popularly known as ecstasy. Now it's called Molly. It's as a street drug. It's used in people use it in raves and dances and so forth. And but originally it was discovered as a in the 80s when as an adjunct to and used as an adjunct to psychotherapy. And it's interestingly different from the drugs like psilocybin and LSD in the sense that it doesn't cause you any visions whatsoever. It doesn't change your perception. What it does, it produces a kind of a opening of the heart center, opening of emotional empathy. And I call them generating a state of empathy easily and effortlessly for oneself and for others. And that's kind of the essence of psychotherapy when you think about it. You know, you want to have empathy, and particularly the application where it's found the most use is in the treatment of trauma. PTSD, whether produced in accidents and or in war and war trauma and so forth. And there's some very, very significant research that's been done, because the traumatized individual is in a state of contracted consciousness where they can hyper alert and hyper energized to the slightest stimuli. That's why you have these stories of these veterans that come back from the war and, you know, they hear a strange sound and they whip out their machine gun and mow down everybody who's standing there, including their family and children. Because it triggers this kind of post-traumatic stress reaction automatically. So with a person like that, you don't really want to give them LSD or psilocybin. That would not be appropriate, because then they'd be hallucinating even more, you see. It's a dissociative response. So ecstasy or MDMA has this amazing capacity to completely turn off the stress mechanisms in a person. So there's no anxiety. People don't have bad trips with it. And like with LSD, people could have bad trips and they could hallucinate their own inner monsters or whatever, their own unconscious id feelings and fears and so forth. This doesn't happen. It turns off the fear response and produces a response that's like the response of the nursing infant who is like in the bosom of his mother, his or her mother, the nursing infant, the infant mother bonding response, prolactin. And oxytocin, these are hormones of nursing. And so the person feels totally safe. And that's the environment you need to have in order to look at trauma. So in the therapy of traumas, whether in war or accident or anything like that, the person is using this substance is allowed to and is able to look at the traumatic the stimuli that they remember, and without reactivating the memories. So, I edited a collection of MDMA experiences called Through the Gateway of the Heart, and there are many examples in there of people who were able to, and the traumatized veterans or other people, and there's some, there's 350,000 veterans from various wars like Vietnam and going back to Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever, who were not treatable. They're given tranquilizers, which kind of paper over, but that's not really a therapy. The therapy takes forever. They may be wounded as well, physically as well. So this is one of the most promising areas of research. And so the organization called MAPS is soliciting funds, and there may be, and there's several government approved research projects going, where they do the studies and the safety studies, and the drug is safe.
Do you recall where those studies are happening, or
is to go to the website of the group called MAPS, which is a kind of coordinating group that raises funds and writes about all the different projects. There's some at the University of North Carolina, MAPS.com or MAPS.org, I think, M-A-P-S.
Is it M-A-P-S or M-A-A-P-S?
No, M-A-P-S, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, .org. And there you'll see a whole list of different studies that they're doing, and they organize getting the permission from the various government agencies, the FDA and DEA and all the different bureaucratic places. But then also the research is not funded by any government agency, so then they have to raise the money from private funding to actually carry out these studies. And then that still doesn't mean the drug is actually available for treatment for anybody. It's a very weird situation, you see, because there's these hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and they hear about these studies, and they basically can't get the medicine. The ordinary person can't get the medicine, except because of the underground. In fact, they can. In fact, they can get the medicine, because there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands, maybe several million people who actually have taken and continue to take that same drug under the different name of ecstasy or Molly or whatever at raves. And, and it's relatively safe. It's not a controlled setting, of course, but there aren't like thousands of corpses lying around anywhere. These people are just taking it and they're just selling it in the street. It's easier for you or me, just as a street person, to get that drug than it is for a researcher to be able to get it.
How do we know about the purity of the drug, though, when we turn to street
drugs.
That's
the problem. On the street, you don't. Except there are some voluntary organizations at the raves and dances. There are some volunteer organizations that set up testing for purity, but basically you don't. That's a consequence of the prohibitionist culture. So you have a prohibitionist culture that makes the obtaining of this drug therapeutically, psychically, psychologically very, very interesting and positive, more positive than any other treatment of trauma, and inexpensive, and you don't have to have special training. You don't have to have a PhD or MD or anything like that. In fact, there are self-help support groups because veterans, you know, lots and lots of veterans have been traumatized, and lots of veterans have themselves access to these various drugs. And in fact, it's sort of like analogous to the AA model. There is a growing movement of veterans who've been traumatized, who have access and have been able to access ecstasy, and then who can then help their others, their buddies, so they're actually in a better position to help their buddies than say a doctor might be, because they've had the experience. This is like the AA, the ex-alcoholics helping the current alcoholics. You see, so
I had not heard of that movement. What about ayahuasca?
You won't hear about it. You see, but yeah. you were asking me about ayahuasca is interesting too. But before I go on to that, you were asking me about the two most interesting applications, I think, of the psychedelic drugs in general. So I think ecstasy or MDMA in the treatment of trauma is one, definitely. And the other one is psilocybin or LSD in the treatment of death anxiety. And death is a trauma, and the anxiety about death is a trauma event that affects everybody, not just veterans. Everybody, without exception, has a certain amount of fear of death, you see. And it's very interesting that studies have been done with psilocybin and LSD. In fact, the famous writer Aldous Huxley, you know, took LSD at the time when he was actually dying. But the studies have been done, and they're approved studies by the FDA and DEA, which is very interesting, where psilocybin, Charles Grobe is a psychiatrist, a friend of mine at UCLA, and some others have in Switzerland have done this study, where people who've been given a medical diagnosis of a terminal diagnosis, in other words, you have 3 months to live, you have cancer, blah, 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 there's no cure. And the research is approved that they can be given psilocybin to alleviate end-of-life anxiety. In other words, nobody's pretending it's not going to cure the cancer, it's not going to stop them from dying, but to alleviate the anxiety around end of life. And that's a very beautiful thing, because as a culture, as a whole, our culture does not deal with end of life issues very well at all. You know, we tend to want to deny it or pepper it over with drugging people out of it. And this doesn't drug people out of it. This gives people a possibility of looking at it with compassion for themselves and insight into the possibility of what is consciousness after death, what does death really mean, like that. And because these substances, and nobody who wants to understand these substances will get anywhere unless they recognize that these substances cannot be approached from a purely behaviorist point of view. They have spiritual implications, and they have mental effects and emotional effects and physical effects, but also, and at its core, it's a spiritual experience, or it can be. It's not guaranteed. Yes. It depends on the setting.
Ayahuasca, I've heard, can often lead to a sort of profound sort of death experience. What are your observations about ayahuasca?
I collected experience. I've written a book on ayahuasca, and I've written one on the mushroom, which is basically a collection of experience accounts and scientific chapters. So both the scientific chapters looking at the botany, the chemistry, the pharmacology, and then the experiences, you know, so both the inner and the outer sciences. And it comes out of these shamanic cultures like the mushrooms do, similarly, widespread South America and the mushrooms, Central America and so forth that have age-old, centuries-old traditions of connecting to spirituality. And in those cultures, these substances, these cultures have a completely different worldview. They exist in a different world than we do. For them, spirits is an ever-present reality everywhere. Spirits before after death, spirits in everyday life, spirits in the family, everything is, every plants, animals, humans, the environment, everything is full of spirits. What are spirits? You see, to the Western mind, these are like hallucinations or imaginings. But to the people in those cultures, it's not imaginings at all. To them, spirits are as real as to us, other human beings are real, sometimes more real. Drug plant-induced visions, as well as dreams or spontaneous visions, are equally real. The reality depends. They're multi-level, multi-dimensional. We live in a multi-dimensional world with spirits at many different levels of reality. And the common feature in the cultures that use ayahuasca and mushrooms and other cultures that use various other substances or no substances at all is a recognition of the reality of intelligent spirits that have their own reality and communicate in their own way and communicate and interact with people. So when people take ayahuasca, it's not the drug that's doing something. The drug is in some way triggering a connection with the spiritual world. And so then the people they may actually see the spirits and they feel the spirits working in them, in their body, in their gut, purging sort of toxic material. And ayahuasca has this peculiar thing because it helps people purge. And you'd think, why, you know, how does a drug that makes people throw up become so popular?
Really.
and my theory about it is that people feel very toxic, you see, and the literature bombards us with the toxicities in our environment, and the scientists are telling us that the waters, the air, the rivers, the earth, everything is toxic, the food, everything is toxic, and we feel toxic, not only physically, but emotionally toxic. Emotional toxicity and things like rage and anxiety and criticism, da da da. And and people feel with ayahuasca, it's very visible toxicity. Similar things can happen with LSD and psilocybin, but it's not so obvious. The person throws up, and immediately afterwards, they feel fantastic. So it's not like throwing up when you're sick. You throw up, and then you feel fantastic, like you've been liberated from this toxic thing inside of you. And that's very convincing. Now, it's not necessarily permanent, but it's, because then you go back to your life and you still have to make the changes. That's true of all psychedelics. They give you a kind of an experience of what it's like not to have these toxic conflicts, conflicting ideas and difficult illusionary ideas. And then you still have to go back and live your ordinary life and your family and your job and your place and da-da-da and work things out. So it's not a magical solution that makes everything go away and then it's roses after that.
Yeah. Now, one thing that made me want to reach out to you at this particular time is the sea change in relation to the legalization of marijuana.
Yes.
Just this past week, Colorado has legalized marijuana for recreational use.
Right.
On the news, we hear that many states are following their experiment very closely,
right,
obviously with hopes of high tax revenues. And if all goes well in Colorado, they'll want to follow suit. CNN has carried some very interesting major reports from the likes of Dr. Sanjay Gupta and Anderson Cooper. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to focus on those to some extent in terms of what you see as the value of both medical and recreational and spiritual uses of marijuana.
Right. Yeah, marijuana or cannabis, cannabis sativa, cannabis indica, is a wonderful, ancient medicinal, therapeutic, and sort of spiritual plant as well, and has all those strands in its spectrum of action. See, that's one of the things about plant medicine or plant and fungal medicine as well in comparison to drugs. See, modern medical system likes to have a specific drug for a specific symptom and everything else is a side effect. Plants and mushrooms and natural products don't actually work that way and the body doesn't work that way. It's not segmented like that. Everything has multiple effects and marijuana, the effects of cannabis on the body and the mind and the emotions, there are hundreds and hundreds of specific effects. It's a multi-systemic plant medicine, extremely non-toxic. There has never been a single death attributed to marijuana smoking. You can't smoke that much marijuana that it would be make you toxic. It's like a ton. You'd have to smoke a ton, and it can't be done. Unlike many of the other drugs that psychiatrists prescribe all the time, people are overdosing on these things all the time. You know, and having horrendously toxic effects from it. This is another case of a very powerful, ancient, historical medicine with amazingly certain forms of cannabis have cured certain kinds of cancer. And cured, not just alleviated the pain, but actually cured the cancer. That's in the published literature.
Really?
Yes, yes. In the 70s already, in the psychiatric literature, certain kinds of cancer. And so it's an Israeli chemist scientist who basically was the one who identified THC, the tetrahydrocannabinol, as the chemical ingredient in the cannabis plant. But there are many different ingredients, and now some of the researchers are exploring some other ones, cannabidiol, which also has some amazingly interesting therapeutic effects and doesn't have the psychoactive effect, for example. So appetite stimulating, various kinds of different counteracting pain and difficulty. So the way the Israeli researchers he formulated it's first of all, it stimulates appetite. So one of the main applications that's found legal permission is in the treatment of the AIDS wasting system or syndrome, where people with AIDS, their immune system is compromised and they don't have any appetite and they can't take anything in. This stimulates appetite and relieves some of the symptoms, and then it allows people to so it stimulates appetite. It helps people relax. It helps people forget stresses. Now, people that, as a psychologist, I always thought, well, you know, it's better to remember than to forget. Isn't necessarily so. You see, because if you think about how every day, you know, we have thousands or dozens or hundreds of situations where we get stressed out, or we have an argument, or an accident, or we get hurt, or we get confused, da da da, and you know, an argument with your husband, your wife, your friend, your job boss, your colleague, whatever. And you don't want to be able to remember all of those kinds of things. So it stimulates the appetite. It helps you to forget the stress of everyday life. And it helps you to sleep. It's a tranquilizing. It produces pleasure. It's actually pleasure-inducing. What a concept, you see. People
right.
are sitting, smoking pot and laughing. Now, let's compare that to alcohol. You know, alcohol doesn't necessarily produce laughing. It might produce, like, jokes about people doing stupid things with alcohol or doing, you know, it loosens your inhibition so you do more aggressive and stupid things and drive your car in a stupid, aggressive way. The pot smoker is not so likely to drive his car. So it's, the toxic effects from alcohol are too well known to, you know, it's not even close comparison.
Yeah.
It causes thousands of deaths every year.
The thing that interested me about some of these TV news stories I've seen on medical marijuana,
right,
and it relates to what you've been saying, is that there are all these different strains that they've developed,
right,
each with very specific properties.
Right.
Now, back in the day, I smoked not a whole lot, but I smoked marijuana, you know, as a street thing. But this is kind of a new era. This isn't your daddy's street grass of yesteryear. That they have these very specific strains for very specific uses.
Yeah, well, that's the way medicine is. You know, it wants to have the specific remedy for a specific illness, and that's okay. That's at one level, yes, that research will probably continue and it'll be more and more widespread. But on the other hand, at the cultural level, the people in Colorado, was it Colorado that made it illegal? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they're not, you know, they're not trading it for the medicinal value. They're taking it for recreational. And that's, from a cultural point of view, it's a much more significant kind of thing, you see. I mean, of course, we want people to have access to medicines that need the medicine. But yes, cultural approval, that's sort of a very deep socio-cultural change. American culture is often, you know, has often been pointed out, is a very puritanical culture. They somehow suspect people who are doing something just for fun. It's somehow, right, you know, you should be doing something more serious. You can't just sitting there having fun.
Right.
There must be something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Culture. Well, what are you thinking? You know, why are you just sitting there thinking, not doing anything?
Yeah. Now, sir, you can't be accused of not doing anything. You've written a whole bunch of books, and you sent me one of your books, which is one of a series. And it's interesting that your books, from what I've seen, I'm generalizing from this one book, but it's a slim volume. I think it's only about 85 pages, but it is packed with information and wisdom, and just covers kind of a sweep of a lot of history with great economy, I must say.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I have this. I have a nonprofit organization, if I might just say that. It's called the Green Earth Foundation. So the website is greenearthfound.org, greenearthfound.org. And I've just finished writing over the past 3 years, 4 years, a series of 7 short books, like 100 pages, plus or minus 10 or 20 each, in which I sort of summarize, condense, synthesize research and work that I've been doing over the last, my own and that of other people, over the past 50 years, actually. I've started working in this field of consciousness-expanding substances, which is what we call them, in 1961, so that's more than 50 years. And the various applications of that and the implications of that for our worldview, for our understanding of the mind and like that, not necessarily always tied to drugs. I mean, drugs are one very powerful, certain drugs are one very powerful method of changing consciousness, but then there are many others and many traditions, for example, the traditions of yoga and meditation, which are equally profound and produce, you know, changes also of a different kind. So what kind of a thing is it that consciousness is? What's the role of consciousness in all different states of consciousness, different dimensions of consciousness? It's very elusive. You see, the scientists and of course, scientists in the West tend to focus on the neuroscience, the brain and the nervous system. And yes, that's totally appropriate, but all of consciousness cannot just be reduced to brain function. There's much more to consciousness than just the brain. And the brain is sort of the physical substrate. But consciousness, we live in a multidimensional universe that has physical and mental and emotional and spiritual dimensions. And you cannot get a complete picture unless you consider all these dimensions. And that's always been true and will always be true.
Do you think you would have been as open to that concept had you not had those early experiences with psilocybin and other substances?
Completely not. See, I had PTSD when I was at Harvard. I was a child. I was traumatized as a child by war. I lived in Germany I was born in Germany in 1936, so I experienced Second World War in Germany. I had experienced bombs dropping and you know, the complete breakdown of society. I was traumatized, and I didn't know it. That's the thing about PTSD. You're traumatized. You don't know such a thing, what that is. You think this is just reality, and especially if you've never known anything else. If you're a war child, you don't know anything else. I was completely withdrawn into myself. I lived in a shell. I could barely talk. My parents took me to a psychiatrist to find out, why isn't he talking? and then, you know, I experienced psilocybin, the synthetic ingredient of the mushrooms at Harvard, when I was 25. So, you know, for 20 years, basically, or close to 20 years, I lived in a shell. And then I you know, my first experience in society was like opening up, oh, there's another whole world. There's another yes. whole world beyond which the world that I thought was the real world is like a small fragment.
Yeah.
That's the classic experience that's been reported many, many times by people like Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, Tim Leary himself, Houston Smith, many, many other philosophers. And of course, they can experience this with other, it's not necessarily only with drugs. It can be had by mystics and many other people in many other ways.
Well, that's maybe a good place for us to wrap it up, unless there's anything else that you want to add.
No, that's good. Yeah, I'll just maybe if I can remind people again, I have this Green Earth Foundation, and you can go to the website greenearthfound.org, and there's a newsletter I have, there's a website, and talks that I give, and these books that are available there too.
I definitely will. I'll put a link in the show notes and in the and definitely let people know about that. So, Dr. Ralph Metzner, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Well, first of all, I must confess to being very impressed by Dr. Metzger's academic credentials. As you heard me say, we've moved around in the same circles more or less for quite a few years, and to me he's always just been Ralph or Ralph Metzger. Now I learned that he did his undergraduate work at Oxford University and his doctoral work at Harvard. And of course he was at Harvard during those culturally critical years of Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert. Personally, I think that LSD/psychedelic period made an important and lasting impression on our culture. It will come as no surprise to my regular listeners that I'm in strong agreement with Dr. Metzger as well as Leary and Alpert about the potentially positive psychotherapeutic and spiritual uses of mind-expanding substances. I do think that they can bring about a kind of conversion experience, if you will, that can change the direction of a person's life. Certainly, they've had that effect on Dr. Metzger, as well as Leary and Alpert, and myself, along with hundreds of thousands of others. I don't know if I'm underestimating or overestimating when I say hundreds of thousands, but at any rate, let's say large numbers. It's always difficult to know about the path not taken, but it seems to me very likely that had I not had the psychedelic experiences that I did have in the past, Shrink Wrap Radio would have a very different orientation and feel overall. And that's if it existed at all. We only touched briefly on Dr. Metzger's extensive writings. To give me some background for our interview, he was gracious enough to send me book number 6 in a series on the ecology of consciousness. He has a real gift for writing with great economy and clarity. I was very impressed by how deftly he was able to traverse great sweeps of history and thought in relatively few pages. And I was equally impressed by the sheer quantity of what he knows. Again, Oxford and Harvard make a lot of sense in that regard. It's clear that he's a real scholar. He was born in Germany, and so he's got that part of the Germanic temperament, but without the bad writing that so often has gone with that temperament. The book he sent me is titled The 6 Paths of Destiny, and the notion is that we choose our incarnation and that we will tend to choose or focus upon one of the 6 paths he describes, which are, and here's the first one, the artist, the storyteller, the poet, and the musician. That's one. The second one is the builder, the organizer, the producer, the engineer. I guess we could refer to them as clusters. The third cluster is the explorer, the scientist, the seeker, the pioneer. The fourth one is the healer, the shaman, the therapist, and the peacemaker. The fifth one is the teacher, the historian, the social scientist, the journalist. The sixth is the warrior, the guardian, the reformer, the activist. Can you guess which one I identified with most? Of course, I saw parts of myself in more than one, But the one that seems most likely for me was the healer, the shaman, the therapist, the peacemaker. I think the peacemaker is particularly central in my personality. I'm afraid my own psychedelic experiences have not opened me up so much as to persuade me of the idea that we choose our incarnations, however, not to mention that there are multiple incarnations. But hey, what do I know? I'd love to discover that I'm wrong about this. By the way, I hope at some point to get around to locating one or more of those who are currently researching the therapeutic value of mind-expanding substances. I guess it's not so much trying to locate, but making the time to actually do the interviews. You'll find quite a few books by Ralph Metzner on Amazon. And as always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site should you decide to order one. In addition, you can purchase books and other resources from his website at www.greenearthfound.org.
This is your conscience calling. This is your conscience calling. It's time to give. Time to give to Dr. Dave and his wonderful, wonderful, intriguing, psychological podcast network. Please give. You'll feel much, much better for it. Just click on the donate button and give what you can to Shrink Wrap Radio. You know you'll feel better. You know it makes sense. So let's all keep the network alive.
Thank you, listener and supporter Phil Schneider, for that very original and creative reminder and call to action. I really appreciate it. Donate today and get your name on the honor roll, which you'll find when you roll over the support tab. And I thank you in advance. Perhaps you recall my recent interview of a week or two ago with Gabrielle Glazer, author of her best-kept secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. Well, imagine my surprise yesterday evening watching the national evening news with Brian Williams, I think it was NBC, and there she is in a major piece about alcohol abuse. It made me feel like I got a scoop getting there first. I put a new poll on our site. Your feedback will provide important guidance for me. For a while, I used to give a fairly short bio intro of my guest just before the interview itself. Not long ago, I heard from a listener who requested that I go back to the way I did it when I first started the show, and which has been my current practice for a while now, which is that I usually read several paragraphs of biographical data about the guest. Some people appreciate that detail about the guest's background, accomplishments, and credentials. Others prefer getting into the interview more quickly. So, the question is, which do you prefer? Several paragraphs of bio about the guest, or just a sentence or two? Or are you fine either way? Currently, we have 12 votes, only 12 votes, and I'd really like to base my decision on considerably more than 12. I mean, help me be scientific here. You'll find the poll in a red box in the right-hand sidebar on the site. You have to scroll way down. Now, this is your show, and I want it to be the way you want it. Thanks to the generosity of volunteers, we do have two new transcripts on the site. First, we have number 376, A Psychodynamic Understanding of Personality Structure with Nancy McWilliams, thanks to Margarita. And we have number 381, Dreams as Guide to the Soul with Stephen Fox, PhD. And that's thanks to longtime champion transcriber Gloria Ullman. And remember, if you'd like to transcribe a favorite episode, just drop a line to me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You should probably go to the transcripts page first to see if that one has already been transcribed or not. Also, let me call your attention to an upcoming online class being presented by our strategic partner, the Jung Platform. And you can get a 15% discount by using our discount code of Dr. Dave. That's just probably in all caps, D-R-D-A-V-E, when you sign up. Now, this course is Robert Bosnack, who I've interviewed, you'll recall, and Patricia Berry, who I'm going to be interviewing. And it's an in-depth course on alchemy, embodying James Hillman's alchemical psychology. So for more information about this, click on the Jung Platform banner ad in the left-hand sidebar on the shrinkwrapradio.com website.
You should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out. Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Thank you, world-famous podcaster and media personality, Adam Curry. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. Actually, I'll read just one today. This one is from Ralph in Germany, who you may recall from my last podcast as well. This time, Ralph writes in response to my praising him for the erudition of his comments. He writes, "Hello, David. I certainly did not set out to become erudite on this subject. I was, as Mao said, just a lone pilgrim wandering in the wilderness. I was referred by a physician to a psychiatric clinic at the Minneapolis General Hospital in 1966. I was 16 years old. The director was Ronald Young, M.D. He asked me how I felt about my father. I told him that I did not get along with him. Ron snapped back, 'Well, did you ever think that maybe he finds you a real pain in the ass?' That was the beginning of a very bad experience. The rest of his crew were just as primitive as he. It was as if a group of farmers with sixth grade educations had been given the works of Sigmund Freud. Ron's head psychologist, Frank, had a set of the complete work of Freud on a bookshelf behind his desk. I say complete because Frank had never actually taken one of the books off the shelf and read it. They had heard somewhere about Freud's ideas on ego defense mechanisms. I think that came from reading Jay Haley's editions of Fritz Perl's writings. The whole staff were always reading those little white paperbacks. Perl's described how to keep patients from jerking the therapists around by turning everything they said into a projection. This crew loved that. Anyhow, I read up on the subject before I returned to therapy in the late 1970s. By this time, the psychologists were into CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. This was even easier to learn than Fritz. Just watch a few Star Trek episodes and listen to Spock say, 'But that's not logical, Captain.' Nothing is either good or bad, but the patient's stupid thinking makes it so. But I also read Jung. The only person whom I had ever met who had read Jung was an ex-con I knew named Gary. This guy was erudite, both Gary and Jung. One thing I learned from Jung was that the patient was an individual. In all the Jung revival talk after the Red Book release, why didn't any of these scholars talk about Jung's refusal to accept Freud's Oedipal theory because it was a one-size-fits-all approach? Other than Rollo May, I found very few writers who objected to the concept of a very narrowly standardized psychopathology introduced by Freud. When I heard Bruce Ecker on your show, I was amazed. I read the book that he wrote with Laura Hulley and Robin Tissick, and I was profoundly moved. Not only are they erudite, they have learned so much from their work with real patients. I think that the future of clinical psychology belongs to this kind of professional, like Leslie Greenberg and Daniel Siegel, multidimensionally erudite. Many thanks." And that's from Ralph in Germany. And Ralph, I still insist that you are erudite. I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. and you can leave voicemail on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to Dr. Ralph Metzner for sharing the deeper meaning of Timothy Leary's challenge to turn on, tune in, and drop out. On the next episode, I will be speaking with the noted journalist Clive Thompson about his fascinating new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. This promises to be a very interesting interview. I hope you'll join me. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some hard traveling way down the road. With a heavy heart and a worried mind, shrink wrap radios are real good find. I've been doing some hard traveling, Lord. He's been doing some good listening, I thought you knowed. Dr. Dave's been podcasting way down the road. With a big fat mic and a soothing voice, you know he's offered you a real good choice. He's been doing some podcasting, Lord. I've been doing some deep traveling, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some deep exploring way down the road. With a happy heart and a bright spirit, life's calling me, ain't gonna fear it. I've been doing some deep traveling, Lord. I've been doing some wide exploring, I thought you knowed. I've been doing some self-exploring way down the road. With Jung and Freud and soul and psyche, Dr. Dave's in my ear to guide. We've been doing some wide traveling, Lord.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.